watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week's show on the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center towers on 9/11/2001 motivated many listeners to take government involvement in the 9/11 attacks seriously and to tell others. That the government is lying about 9/11 is easy to prove, but for many people, it is hard to believe or risky to talk about. In the agroecological discipline of permaculture, which I hope to present more on the program in the coming months, there's a principle that the problem is the solution. The acceptance of the lie of 9/11 is the problem. It promulgates fear and submission and legitimizes endless war and an American police state. Breaking the spell of the 9/11 cover story is the key to setting free resistance to resurgent fascism in America. Resisting this is the obligation of the American people. 20th century history clearly teaches us what happens when resistance comes too late. Last week on the program, I read you about Operation Northwoods, a 1960s plan created by the Pentagon and nixed by President Kennedy, which called for the government to stage terrorist attacks in the United States that would then be blamed on Cuba and used as a pretext for an invasion of that country. Some time ago, we also broadcast about an aborted coup in the 1930s against the FDR administration, which was hatched by some of the nation's most powerful capitalists who tried to recruit Marine General Smedley Butler to be the military dictator of the United States. A totalitarian tendency has been present in the American body politic since the nation's beginnings. Though the United States is not alone in this, the point is that the United States is not exempt from this. And in every country that falls to totalitarian regimes, we see the same alliances, men of wealth and generals. During the question and answer part of Professor David Ray Griffin's talk last week, he mentioned that he had been giving another lecture during his tour on the subject of the failure of military jets to intercept the hijacked airlines on 9/11. I've obtained a recording of that lecture, and I'm going to play it for you tonight. This is something else you'll want to tape to be able to listen to again. You'll be able to download an MP3 or podcast later from unwelcomeguests.org. Let us begin, though, with a few pieces from a variety of sources that provide some context. First, I'm going to read you an excerpt from an article of February 10th, from a blog titled George Washington's Blog. The author, using the nom de plume George Washington, writes, "The anthrax attacks of 2001 and nerve agent scare of 2006 helped to clarify and explain what is happening in our country. The anthrax attacks, which were sent along with notes purportedly written by Islamic terrorists, used a weaponized anthrax strain from the top U.S. bioweapons facility, the Fort Detrick military base. Indeed, top bioweapons experts have stated that the anthrax attack may have been a CIA test, quote, gone wrong." The blog links to articles supporting these assertions. The blogger then continues, "Interestingly, White House staff began taking the anti-anthrax medicine before the anthrax attacks occurred. Moreover, the only Congress people mailed anthrax-containing letters were key Democrats, and the attacks occurred 1 week before the passage of the Freedom Curtailing Patriot Act, which seems to have scared them and the rest of Congress into passing that act without even reading it. This is not a partisan issue, since this author believes that party affiliation is not a reliable indicator of loyalty to the Constitution. Rather, the senators targeted just happened to pose a threat in 2001 to passage of the Patriot Act. History appears to be repeating itself this week. Only hours after censors in a U.S. Senate office building detected a nerve agent, key senators suddenly reversed direction and announced a capitulation to the White House's demands on the renewal and expansion of the Patriot Act. The anthrax attacks and nerve agent scare helped to illustrate that America's enemies are inside the gates, and that they are more than willing to use scare tactics and even false flag terror methods to achieve their objectives. While 9/11 was mainly aimed at the American people, the anthrax attacks and nerve gas scare were apparently aimed at Congress. Specifically, the bioterror scares appear to have been launched in order to instill sufficient fear and disruption among the few remaining legislators who still honor the Constitution, so that they would be willing to let the Patriot Act be passed and then reenacted without real analysis or debate. Without 9/11, the American public would not have given in to the Bush administration's imperial agenda. Without the bioterror scares, Congress would not have let the Constitution be demolished so quickly. That from George Washington's blog at georgewashington.blogspot.com. You can read that entire article with its supporting hyperlinks there, or follow a link via unwelcomeguests.org. Next, a report on yet another secret memo documenting the Bush administration's determination to attack Iraq at all costs and to use various methods of deliberate subterfuge to gain support for war. This story comes from Channel 4 in the United Kingdom, and it deals with revelations in a new book by a British international law specialist, Philippe Sands, QC.
It was the most critical meeting in the tense weeks before the Iraq War. Face-to-face talks in the White House between President Bush and Tony Blair, along with their most senior officials. Channel 4 News has seen a secret memo which details that discussion between the two leaders. The president makes it clear there'll be war on Saddam regardless of whether the UN passes a further resolution. The prime minister replies he is, quotes, solidly with the president. And George Bush even floats the idea of trying to lure Saddam into war by flying an American spy plane over Iraq painted in UN colours. The details are contained in a new version of the book Lawless World by the leading international lawyer Philippe Sands, QC. Our political editor Gary Gibbon has this exclusive report.
January 31st, 2003. Tony Blair is heading to the White House. This would be one of the most critical meetings in the build-up to war. France, Germany, Russia and many in Britain wanted the UN inspections in Iraq to have more time. Saddam Hussein had made what he called a full declaration of his past chemical and biological weaponry. But with forces mounting on Iraq's border, Tony Blair knew war was almost certainly not far off. He wanted the world to unite against Saddam. He wanted the US to back a second resolution of the United Nations. But there had been no smoking gun found in Iraq to turn round world opinion, and both leaders knew it.
Channel 4 News has seen a memo of the White House meeting which records that critical summit. The memo paints a picture of two leaders intensely aware that even though they think Saddam Hussein has done enough to justify war, much of the world is disagreeing and angry. The White House meeting memo conveys an air of desperation as the two leaders cast around for how world opinion might be turned.
The White House meeting memo says President Bush told Mr. Blair the US was thinking of flying U-2 reconnaissance aircraft with fighter cover over Iraq, painted in UN colours. If Saddam fired on them, he would be in breach. The US had in the past flown spy planes over Iraq. It had flown them in the colours and service of the UN, but a senior UN source told us they were perfectly capable of flying above the range of Iraqi missiles, and the fighter escorts and talk of Saddam firing on them suggests to some that the US was almost willing Saddam to strike out at the plane.
Author Philippe Sands.
I think the context is clear, that by January 2003, it appears that the British Prime Minister and the US President were conscious that they had no evidence of their own, that it was increasingly likely that Hans Blix would not come up with the big smoking gun that Jack Straw wanted, and that they would therefore have to procure a material breach through some other means. And I think against that background, it's very hard to find a charitable explanation for this type of discussion between the heads of these two countries.
It would have gone through all senior people in the administration, the papers preparing for such a meeting.
Claire Short, former cabinet minister.
And it means that at senior levels in the US administration, crazy, illegal, deceitful proposals like that were actually being contemplated to trigger a war by deceit.
We just had a wide-ranging discussion on a lot of issues.
A new book by the international lawyer Philippe Sands makes clear that Mr. Blair at this meeting also heard the president suggest there might be other ways of altering the course of events. The book gives details of the White House meeting memo in which President Bush says it was also possible that a defector could be brought out who would give a public presentation about Saddam's WMD, and there was also a small possibility that Saddam would be assassinated. But Mr. Blair doesn't seem to be too optimistic about those possibilities, and he pursues the main reason for his trip to the US. He wants President Bush to throw his weight behind an attempt to get a second UN resolution authorising war. Mr. Blair has been advised he needs it to have a hope of getting parliamentary backing for war. President Bush is being advised by much of his top team not to go near the United Nations again. According to the White House meeting memo, the Prime Minister said that a second Security Council resolution would provide an insurance policy against the unexpected and international cover, including with the Arabs.
What is important is that the international community comes together again and makes...
President Bush would later refer to this two-hour meeting as the famous second resolution meeting. He did agree, against the advice of many in his administration, to give the UN another try. But he also made it clear that even if there was no second UN resolution, war would happen, and soon. The White House meeting memo, seen by Channel 4 News outside the UK, records that President Bush said the US would put its full weight behind efforts to get another resolution and would twist arms and even threaten. But he had to say that if ultimately we failed, military action would follow anyway. Tony Blair responds that he is solidly with the president and ready to do whatever it took to disarm Saddam. Just before the meeting with President Bush, Mr. Blair gave a round of interviews at the British Embassy in Washington. He was asked, was there already a date in the diary for war?
Well, no, there's not a specific deadline that we have alighted upon.
But later, at the White House meeting, Mr. Blair learnt there was a specific date President Bush had in mind, the 10th of March. The window for winning round the rest of the world to a new UN resolution was tight and pretty much immovable. War actually began on March the 20th. Joining the president at the meeting were his then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, her deputy Dan Freed, and the Chief of Staff for the White House, Andrew Card. The Prime Minister took along his then Security Advisor David Manning, along with his then Foreign Policy Aide Matthew Rycroft, and his Chief of Staff, Jonathan Powell. The whole tone of the White House meeting seems to be two leaders who don't feel they have enough evidence of a breach to convince the world. But their own position is that Saddam is already in breach because of lack of cooperation with inspectors. But that doesn't appear to be the view of the Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, according to a private letter he sent Tony Blair in early January 2003, reported in a new book by the international lawyer Philippe Sands.
Mr. Straw's note seems to indicate his belief that as of January 2003, Saddam Hussein's Iraq was not in material breach. And of course, if Saddam Hussein's Iraq was not in material breach at the beginning of January 2003, nothing happened after that date to bring him into material breach, and it means that the entire argument of material breach unravels.
Back at the 30th January meeting, President Bush told the Prime Minister he didn't expect Iraq to erupt in violence after its liberation. President Bush told Mr. Blair he thought it unlikely that there would be internecine warfare between the different religious and ethnic groups. British journalists accompanying the Prime Minister were given a document supposed to strengthen the case for war, but a chunk of it turned out to be lifted off the internet. It would become known as the dodgy dossier. The Prime Minister was running out of time to win round opinion, and in Washington and London, some of the attempts to turn things round were looking increasingly ragged and desperate.
That report from February 3rd in the UK, it received little notice in the American media. One question often asked is, if the official 9/11 story is false, how could such an elaborate lie be maintained when so many must be involved in either the acts themselves or the cover-up? The following interview will shed some light on that. What you're about to hear is an interview with a prominent conservative economist, Paul Craig Roberts, who was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration and is responsible for what he calls supply-side economics and others call Reaganomics, that were responsible for creating, among other things, homeless people as a persistent social category and a lot of rich people getting even richer. Roberts was associate editor of the Wall Street Journal editorial page and contributing editor of National Review. He is co-author of The Tyranny of Good Intentions. Earlier this month, he was interviewed by George Kenney, a former career diplomat who resigned his post in Yugoslavia in 1991 in protest of U.S. policy there. Kenney now produces a podcast, Electric Politics, as part of his website, electricpolitics.com. The first voice we hear is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts.
Prior to 9/11, it looked like Bush was going to be wiped out by the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a very weak position. A lot of people thought that they had stolen the election. He was elected by one Supreme Court vote.
Right.
The Democrat line was that he was an illegitimate president, and it looked like he was going nowhere. 9/11 rescued him.
Right.
Karl Rove knew that instantly. He said, aha, this is the shield. They can't be against the guy who's protecting them from terrorists who blew up the World Trade Center and attacked the Pentagon. And so they have used this kind of fear and hysteria. And this is Bush's shield. As long as he's got that, he gets away with whatever he wants. He tells Congress, I don't have to obey your laws. I'm not accountable to your oversight. I don't have to obey the Constitution. And nobody does anything about it, and it's all because of the interpretation placed on 9/11.
Well, this gets into some rather dark and murky waters, but I was surprised, very surprised, to be honest, when I was talking with Ray McGovern, and he started to go on about all the anomalies in 9/11 and how the standard story didn't make sense. And at the time, I wasn't really sure I wanted to talk about all that, so I steered the conversation elsewhere. But just to make a note of it, there are a lot of really smart people with sterling credentials who have noticed that there are difficult problems with the 9/11 story that the standard explanation can't account for. And just yesterday, in the Miami Herald, there was a column, 9/11 attacks avoiding the hard question. So this kind of thinking is sort of percolating slowly into the mainstream. Just as a personal thing, right after the events, I went down across from the Pentagon. There's a sort of a raised hill, I don't know, maybe 40 feet off above the highway there, and people were going and laying wreaths and looking at the building and everything. And so I drove down and took a look, and I must say that I find it very difficult to imagine, and I'm not an expert on aircraft accidents, but I do have some experience in observing things, and just looking at that, it did not look to me like a major airliner went into that building. So,
yeah, I suppose you know about this these 9/11 scholars.
Yeah,
who have they're physicists. Even includes the German defense minister and the head of the German Secret Service. It's a wide variety of people with impressive credentials, and they say the 9/11 Commission report is a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have not really, you know, I've been worrying about jobs and
right.
and foreign policy, and I haven't really looked at it very close, but I did go to Georgia Tech, and I did learn some physics, and I know enough physics to know that it is strictly impossible for buildings to collapse in their own footprint
mm-hmm.
at free fall speed
mm-hmm.
except under controlled demolition.
Mm-hmm.
Those buildings did not come down the way the 9/11 report says. It's strictly impossible. In fact, it's a total, the account in the 9/11 report is a total contradiction to the laws of physics.
You know, recently, without going into a whole lot of detail about this, because I'm not an expert on it either, but I did notice that New York City, I guess after some legal wrangling, finally released late last year the oral history statements by a number of people who had been working in the towers. And it's fascinating because there are people who were on the mechanical engineering staff who were in the lower levels. And before the buildings had fallen, they reported seeing explosions and 5-ton doors that had been wrinkled like tissue paper and various kinds of machine tools that had been vaporized. So there was some kind of explosion down there before the buildings fell.
Yeah, the oral histories, I've seen some reports on that and read some of them, and they all say that they heard a series of explosions floor by floor.
Mm-hmm.
That's controlled demolition.
So we have to
There's no other way to explain. Yeah. See, most people don't even know. They think the only buildings that fell were the two towers.
Right, but yeah, Building 7. Yeah.
But Building 7 was hit by nothing, and the same thing happened.
And that would be, it's the first time ever that a building was sort of on its own due to fire, a steel structure building would collapse. And you'd think that the engineering profession would want to know why.
If you know, they'll talk, some of them will tell you privately, but if they say it publicly, they lose clients for their firms because everybody gets mad. You're against the government. You're
right.
Against the country.
Right. Right.
You're a traitor. You don't believe Bush. You know, this is what happened. So they don't say anything. The physicists in universities, very few of them can say anything because they all live on government grants.
Right.
People don't understand how hard it is in America to speak the truth. It's almost impossible.
That's right, yeah.
Everywhere you go, you see, I'm not allowed to even write about it by my editors.
Is that so?
So that's one reason I don't know much about it. But it doesn't. I tried to find out something once, and I pointed out some of the really major holes in the story, and they just said, don't write about it. You're not allowed to write about it. You'll ruin your credibility. Everybody say you're a conspiracy theorist, and then they won't believe what you say about jobs.
Well, you know, I was really impressed with the book by David Ray Griffin. There's a guy.
Yeah, he's very brave.
He's very brave, and he's a mainstream theologian. He was a professor for 30 years at Claremont Graduate School, teaching the logic of religion. He's known as
But what, you know, his problem is he's not a physicist or a structural engineer. So they say, well, how do you know? And yeah. Since they don't know themselves, they can't tell whether he knows or not. Do you see?
Yeah.
The real breakthrough, I think, has been some of the physicists who stood up, like this professor Stephen Jones at BYU.
BYU, yeah. Although they muzzled him pretty quickly.
They muzzled him quickly. It's very easy to see why. The federal government calls up and says, do you realize how many research grants the university gets from the federal government?
Yeah. So, it's tough because you need a theory to beat a theory, and what we've got are a set of observations that the current story is implausible, but it's so hard to come up with a scenario that would explain and account for all these things. You know, who did it? Why did they do it? All that. It's a really tough one.
I think the evidence is unequivocal,
mm-hmm.
that controlled demolition was used to bring down those buildings.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we know who wired them or why or what. I mean, maybe they were wired in the event that something crashed into them and they started to topple and destroy half of Lower Manhattan, and so they wanted to have some way to bring them down. Maybe that had been done, and maybe something set it off.
It's a thought.
Maybe the attack set it off, or maybe the people panicked and decided to bring them down. But it didn't happen. I don't know why and what, and I have no theory. All I know is mm-hmm. it didn't happen the way they say it happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good. I'm glad we talked about that. Okay, well, let's go on with Iraq and Iran. And I wanted to look at one other aspect of the Iranian thing, and that is the extent to which China has its eye on Iranian oil, and China is involved then in whatever we do with regard to Iran. I know you've noticed the book Petrodollar Warfare by William Clark and praised it. It's interesting. He's a guy who doesn't have experience in these areas, but he's brought together a number of notions in a very original way, and I think that his point about Chinese interest in Iran is pretty well taken. Could you comment on that?
Well, let me let me take it in a very general way.
Okay.
I think that the Russians and the Chinese, along with the rest of the world, think that we're insane. Everyone knows that Iran hasn't any nuclear weapons or any nuclear weapon program. That's what the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors themselves have said. Mm-hmm. Iran is cooperating in the sense that they allow all of the inspections under the treaty, and under the treaty they have the right to nuclear energy. So what we're doing is saying, well, we're not going to let you have the treaty rights because we don't trust you.
I guess if you read between the lines, what the U.S. and particularly the Israelis are worried about is if the Iranians get past a certain threshold where they understand the cycle and then at their leisure could begin to accumulate enriched uranium.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult if you're subject to constant inspections.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. I think that what we have a different agenda, and we're using this to set them up. There's no basis to the American objection except they want war. That's the only reason. Now, the question is, why will the rest of the world let us have it? Well, it's not in Russia or China's interest to have their oil agreements with Iran disturbed. On the other hand, it is in their interest for us to dig ourselves into a deeper hole.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because if oil is disrupted in the Middle East, any bit of it, it makes Europe that much more dependent on Russia. And Russia, of course, is already bothered by us taking bases, NATO bases, to their frontier. Well, the minute the NATO countries are totally dependent on Russia for oil and gas, that's the end of our influence in Europe.
That's a good point.
So yeah. Russia has a lot to gain, probably more to gain than lose, by letting Bush start a war with Iran.
Hmm.
China, too, because they will be financing the war. We don't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
All of this $500 billion Bush is talking about is going to be barred from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And so, mm-hmm. Fine, let us get in deeper. It's easier for them to take Taiwan.
And any remaining American industry that they'd like.
That's right. And if we say anything about it, they'll say, oh, we've got $1 billion in treasury bonds. We don't want them anymore. Would you like to buy them back? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's not, we're not in a defensible position. So I think there's a, and of course the Europeans are just pressured every which way, trade agreements, everything else, to go along with our attack on Iran. So everybody's interest is served by letting Bush create a worse disaster for the United States and for the Iranians. And so it may happen.
Hmm.
And the consequences, of course, are disastrous because it's a war crime. Unprovoked aggression is a war crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wars based on lies discredit the government, the concept of democracy. We already have Bush saying that his powers as commander-in-chief are not restrained by statutory law or by the Constitution.
All these signing statements, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, plus signing statements that this law doesn't apply to me if I don't want it to. We now have, just the other day, you know, he refused to turn over documents to a congressional investigation, stating in effect that he was no longer subject to congressional oversight.
You're talking about the Katrina documents?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you won't even turn over hurricane documents because you're not subject to oversight, what is he subject to?
Yeah.
He's become totally unaccountable.
Yeah.
What's to make him hold elections?
I worry about that too, yeah.
I mean, if he can pick up people anywhere in the world without a warrant, hold them in indefinite detention wherever he wants,
torture
without
them,
producing any evidence.
Kill them, maybe.
He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
So we've already got a person behaving as if he's a dictator. And we're seeing very little opposition to this. Very, very little opposition.
It's very sad. Yeah.
It's scary. It makes you wonder, what if there's another terrorist event, either real or staged, whatever. Another terrorist event. You could see very easily that they would say, well, look, it's too dangerous to hold an election.
Well, I think that they've had plans to take care of that situation for a while. They just haven't dared to use them. But
it really depends on how long they continue to fool half roughly half the population.
On the off chance that Congress would find a spine and go ahead and impeach Bush, then after that, I would hope that he would be tried in court, starting with war crimes and going on from there, and then be sent to jail. Would that
be
it?
Yeah, I think he and the entire government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if they don't impeach him, the America will have seen the end of the separation of powers, that the Congress will become a rump like the Roman Senate under the Caesars.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on the verge of that right now. Now, that sounds like, oh, how could that possibly be in the United States? We have liberty and democracy, blah, blah. So the Roman Republic. But it's very easy to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose it by giving in to executive claims of power. And that's what we're doing. Of course, it's been going on a long time, but it's really bad now. I mean, it's really accelerating. And it's not done under cover. The cover is 9/11. Mm-hmm. That's the only cover for this. And when it's happened in the past, it's had other kinds of things. And it wasn't the blatant issue that it is now. But what we see now is he's simply saying, I'm not accountable, and he can even flout his criminality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not obeying the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I'm not obeying it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't apply to me.
I'm kind of skeptical that the Democrats on their own can do this. I think that to remedy the situation, you'd really have to have a bipartisan group. But how could one get the Republicans to...
I don't think they will, you see, because it's different now from Nixon's time. In Nixon's time, there was a lot of just corruption and power grabbing and all the rest, but there were still some people who had some fault to the country,
mm-hmm.
who were still imbued with constitutional principles and thought they're important. Today, it's just power.
Right.
Republicans are interested in nothing but power.
Power and money, yeah.
Power. They're not even interested in money, except as it helps power.
Hmm.
See, so if you have a party that's totally motivated by power and being in power, and we've got power, by God, we're not giving it up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this, you know, they've got both houses and the presidency. So I think if the American people don't put Congress in the hands of Democrats, or at least one house, in this November,
yeah,
that we will have a dictatorship.
Hmm. Well, Paul, how do your former Republican colleagues react when they hear you say stuff like this? I'm sure that doesn't really matter to you, but do your friends from earlier times disown
you?
Well,
some of them agree. Some of them agree with me.
Uh-huh.
Some of the Reagan people agree. I mean, look, Pat Buchanan has been very outspoken.
He flips and flops around a little bit on this.
Well, he has to survive. He's in Washington.
He does. That's true.
See, I'm not there anymore.
Yeah.
If I was in Washington, I'd probably have to be flipping back and forth, too.
Mm-hmm.
But still, he speaks out.
He does, yes.
And I know, and some others up there that have been active for their whole life in Republican, not the politics side, but the policy side, you know, the policy wonks. Some of those, they send my stuff around, despite the opprobrium that comes back on them for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some. And I get emails from Republicans and who lifelong Republicans who say they can't believe this guy.
Right.
This is happening. I get it. So.
Actually, I know a few like that myself.
And a lot of World War II vets and Vietnam vets, they write in and say, how is this happening? This is not what we fought for.
Mm-hmm.
So some people do see it. Not everyone is blind. See, Americans, too, don't understand that in the 1990s, that was the end of the American media because the government permitted massive concentration. So
yeah.
Now just a few corporate hands control the media.
Right.
They're not going to risk their broadcast licenses
by
getting
not.
On the wrong side of the government.
Very valuable. Yeah.
And they're not going to risk their advertising revenues by being controversial. The last thing they want is to be attacked as being unpatriotic or against the president or... So the news people, so-called news, that get is a very carefully controlled line. Plus, you got to ask yourself this. How long has Bush been using the NSA to spy on people?
Mm-hmm.
The entire time of his presidency,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it's not just something he's done for the last year. He's been doing this since he's been there. So since he can spy just as easily by going to the court, as by not going, he doesn't gain any ability to spy on terrorists by refusing to obey the law.
Clearly, yeah.
Why does he refuse to obey the law? Because he's not spying just on terrorists. He's spying on the Democrats, the media.
Members
he's
of Congress.
Getting all kind of blackmail material to shut them up.
Right.
I think this is the explanation of why the Democrats are so feeble. I have never seen a party so feeble when they had so many targets and opportunities.
That was Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, being interviewed by George Kenney. This was an excerpt of a two-hour conversation that you can hear in its entirety at electricpolitics.com. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, RadioVeronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. Next, we turn once again to David Ray Griffin, Professor Emeritus of the Philosophy of Religion at Claremont College, and author of many books on that subject, but more importantly for our discussion, also the author of two books on 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor and The 9/11 Commission, Omissions and Distortions. Thanks to Active Ingredients, we bring this lecture, recorded last October in Brattleboro, Vermont. Here's Professor David Ray Griffin.
At the end of 2004, I published the 9/11 Commission report, Omissions and Distortions. Shortly before that book appeared, I gave a lecture in Santa Rosa, California, in which I set out to summarize its main points. Unfortunately, the report itself contains so many omissions and distortions that I only got through the first half of my book, from which a DVD was made and is now available. The present lecture summarizes the second half of my book, which deals with the Commission's explanation as to why the military was unable to intercept any of the hijacked airliners. This explanation was provided in the first chapter of the 9/11 Commission report. Although that chapter is only 45 pages long, the Commission's account is so complex that it took me 6 chapters in my book to analyze it. That part of my book turned out to be the most difficult part of the book for people to read because the story is very complex. I'm trying in this lecture to make it a little easier to understand, but you will still find it quite complex because you've got the 4 flights, you have 3 different versions of the story, you have all these different times. So let me encourage you not to worry about the details, but just to get the overall gestalt, my point is that not a single part of the new official story makes any sense. We have had 3 different versions of the official story as to why the military failed to intercept the airliners. To see why 3 versions have been thought necessary, we need first to understand standard operating procedures. These standard procedures dictate that if an FAA flight controller notices anything that suggests a possible hijacking, they lose radio contact, the transponder goes off, or the plane deviates radically from its course, the controller is to contact a superior. If the problem cannot be fixed quickly, say within a minute, the superior is to ask NORAD to scramble jet fighters from the nearest Air Force base that has fighters on alert to see what is going on. NORAD then issues this scramble order. On 9/11, all of the hijacked airliners occurred in NORAD's Northeast Air Defense Sector, which is known as NEADS. So all the scramble orders would have come from NEADS that day. The jet fighters at the disposal of NEADS could respond very quickly. According to the U.S. Air Force website, F-15s can go from scramble order to 29,000 feet in 2.5 minutes, and then they can fly at speeds upwards of 1,800 miles an hour. Therefore, according to General Ralph Eberhardt, the head of NORAD, after the FAA senses that something is wrong, it takes about 1 minute for it to contact NORAD, after which NORAD can scramble jet fighters within a matter of minutes to anywhere in the United States. Eberhardt's statement was, to be sure, made after 9/11. So we might suspect that this reflected a post-9/11 speed-up of procedures, and that's what people have told us. And yet, an air traffic control document put out in 1998 warned pilots that any airplanes persisting in unusual behavior will likely find two jet fighters on their tail within 10 or so minutes. On 9/11, however, that did not happen. Where was the military? The military's first answer, given immediately after 9/11, was provided by General Richard Myers, the acting chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and also independently by Mike Snyder, a spokesman for NORAD. They said that no military jets were sent up until after the strike on the Pentagon. That strike occurred at 9:38, and yet at 8:15, Flight 11 had shown two of the standard signs of hijacking, losing both the radio and the transponder signal. That means that procedures that usually result in an interception within 10 or so minutes had not been carried out in 80 or so minutes. That enormous delay suggested that a stand-down order had been issued, and a stand-down order canceling standard operating procedures. Some people started raising this possibility. Very quickly, a new story appeared. On Friday, September 14th, CBS News said, contrary to early reports, U.S. Air Force jets did get into the air on Tuesday while the attacks were underway, although they arrived too late to prevent the attacks. The second story was then made official on September 18th, 1 week after 9/11, when NORAD produced a timeline stating the times it was notified about each flight by the FAA and then the times at which it issued the scramble orders. The implicit message of the timeline was that the failure to intercept was due entirely to the FAA, because in each case it notified the military so late that interceptions were impossible. Not everyone, however, accepted that conclusion. Some early members of the 9/11 Truth Movement showed that NORAD's new timeline did not get it off the hook. With regard to the first flight, even if we accept NORAD's claim that NEADS was not notified about Flight 11 until 8:40, NORAD's implicit claim that it could not have prevented an attack on the World Trade Center is problematic. If fighters had immediately been scrambled from McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey, they could have intercepted Flight 11 before 8:47, which is when the North Tower was struck. NORAD, to be sure, had a built-in answer to that criticism. It claimed that McGuire had no fighters on alert, so it had to give the scramble order to relatively far away Otis Air Force Base in Cape Cod. Critics argued that this claim is probably a lie, for reasons to be discussed later. Even less plausible, the critics said, was NORAD's claim that NEADS did not have time to prevent the second attack. NEADS had been notified about Flight 175 at 8:43, 20 minutes before the South Tower was struck. The F-15s, originally ordered to go after Flight 11, were now told to go after Flight 175. The scramble order, NORAD said, was given at 8:46. Given the military's own statement that F-15s can go from scramble order to 29,000 feet in 2.5 minutes and then fly at 1,800 miles an hour, the F-15s, even if they had come from Otis Air Force Base in Cape Cod, would have been streaking towards Manhattan by 8:49, so they could have easily gotten there before 9:03 when the South Tower was struck. NORAD said, however, that it took the F-15s 6 minutes just to take off. Critics said it looked like a stand-down order, or at least a slow-down order, had been issued. Critics also pointed out that even if the F-15s did not take off until 8:52, they still could have gotten to Manhattan in time to prevent the second attack, assuming that they were going full speed. And according to one of the pilots, they were. Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Duffy said they went full blower all the way. And yet, according to NORAD's timeline, when the South Tower was hit at 9:03, the F-15s were still 71 miles away. The fighters could not have been going even half lower. It still looked like a stand-down order, or at least a slow-down order, had been issued. The same problem existed with respect to NORAD's explanation of its failure to protect the Pentagon. NORAD again blamed the FAA, saying that although the FAA knew about the hijacking of Flight 77 before 9 o'clock, it did not notify NORAD until 9:24, too late for NORAD to respond. Again, doing the math showed that this explanation did not work. NORAD claimed that it issued the scramble order immediately at 9:24. The attack on the Pentagon did not occur until 14 minutes later at 9:38. That would have been more than enough time for jet fighters to get there from Andrews Air Force Base, which is only a few miles away. Why, then, did NORAD not prevent this attack? Part of NORAD's answer was that no fighters were on alert at Andrews, so that Needs had to give the scramble order to Langley Air Force Base, which is about 130 miles away. Also, it again took the pilots 6 minutes just to get airborne, so they'd not get away until 9:30. However, even if those explanations are accepted, the scrambled F-16s, critics pointed out, could go 1,500 miles per hour, so they could have reached Washington a couple minutes before the Pentagon was struck. But according to NORAD, they were still 105 miles away. That would mean that the F-15s were going less than 200 miles an hour, which would not even be one-quarter blower. In all three cases, NORAD's attempt to put all the blame on the FAA failed. Critics were able to show, especially with regard to the second and third flights, that NORAD's news story still implied that a stand-down order must have been given. It is perhaps not surprising, therefore, that the 9/11 Commission came up with a brand new story, which is not subject to the same objections. But the main question is still the same. Is it true? One reason to suspect that it is not true is that it is the third story we have been given. You know, in an ordinary criminal case, you start to get suspicious if one of the suspects says, oh, I couldn't have pulled off that robbery. I was at the movie. And the police say, you couldn't have been. The movie theater was closed that night. Oh, that's right. I was with my girlfriend. No, we checked with your girlfriend, and she was home with her husband that night. And so he says, well, I was actually home reading my Bible. So when this happens, we suspect that someone is trying to conceal the truth. But an even more serious problem with the Commission's new story is that many of its elements are contradicted by credible evidence or are otherwise implausible. I will show this by examining the Commission's treatment of each flight, beginning with Flight 11. As we saw, flight controllers are supposed to react quickly if they see only one of the three standard signs of a hijacking. But Flight 11 hit the trifecta, showing all three signs, and yet no one at the Boston FAA Center, we are told, took any action. Eventually, Boston, having heard hijackers giving orders, called the FAA Command Center in Herndon. Herndon then called FAA headquarters in Washington, but no one there, we are told, called the military. Finally, the FAA Center in Boston called Needs directly at 8:38. To accept this story, we would have to believe that although the FAA should have notified the military about Flight 11 within a minute of seeing the danger signals at 8:15, the FAA personnel at Boston, Herndon, and Washington were all so incompetent that they didn't notify the military for 23 minutes. We would then need to reconcile this picture of top-to-bottom incompetence, which contributed to thousands of deaths, with the fact that no FAA personnel were fired or even publicly reprimanded. The next implausible element in the story involves Colonel Robert Marr, the commander at Needs. As we saw earlier, if he had had planes scrambled immediately, even from Otis, they might have prevented the first attack on the World Trade Center. And yet, we are told, he called down to Florida to General Larry Arnold, the head of NORAD's U.S. Continental Region, to get authorization to have planes scrambled, and this phone call took 8 minutes. Besides the fact that this would be an extraordinary long telephone call in an emergency situation, the call was not even necessary. The commission would have us believe otherwise. But the very document from the Defense Department that it cites says that anyone in the military chain of command, after receiving verbal requests from civil authorities for support in an emergency, may immediately respond. So Colonel Mars could have responded immediately. But this tale of an 8-minute phone call is probably not the biggest lie in the commission's story about Flight 11. That award seems to belong to the claim that although the FAA saw signs of hijacking at 8:15, the military was not notified until 8:38. Blogger Tom Fluckel says that he was told by two people, a source in the Transportation Department and Laura Brown, the FAA's deputy in public affairs, that the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon had set up an air threat teleconference that morning at about 8:20. If those two sources are correct, it would seem that the military knew about Flight 11's erratic behavior shortly after 8:15, which would mean that the FAA had followed standard operating procedures. I turn now to the Commission's treatment of Flight 175. The Commission claims that NORAD did not intercept this flight because the FAA never told it about it, told the military about this flight's hijacking until after the flight had hit the South Tower of the World Trade Center. According to the Commission, the flight controller at the FAA did not even notify a manager until 8:55. This manager then called the FAA Command Center at Herndon, saying, "The situation is escalating, big time. We need to get the military involved." But no one at Herndon called the military or even FAA headquarters in Washington. As a result, we are told, NORAD did not learn about the hijacking of this flight until 9:03, when it was crashing into the South Tower. One problem with this story is that such incompetence by FAA officials is hardly believable. An even more serious problem is that this story is contradicted by many prior reports. One of these prior reports is NORAD's own previous timeline. As we saw earlier, NORAD had maintained for almost 3 years that it was notified about Flight 175 at 8:43. If that was not true, as the Commission now claims, NORAD, when it put out its timeline 1 week after 9/11, must have either been lying or terribly confused. And it is hard to believe that it could have been so confused a week after the event. So it must have been lying. But that would suggest that it had an ugly truth to conceal. The Commission, being unable to embrace either of these possible explanations, simply tells us, without explanation, that NORAD's previous statement was incorrect. The Commission's claim that the military did not know about Flight 175 until it crashed is also contradicted by a report involving Captain Mike Jelinek, a Canadian who on 9/11 was overseeing NORAD's headquarters in Colorado. According to a story in the Toronto Star, Jelinek, who was on the phone with Needs as he watched Flight 175 crash into the South Tower, asked Needs, "Was that the hijacked airliner you were dealing with?" To which Needs said, "Yes." Still another problem with the Commission's new story is that there appear to have been two teleconferences during which FAA officials would have talked to the military about Flight 175. I have already mentioned the teleconference initiated by the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon. The 9/11 Commission claims, to be sure, that this teleconference did not begin until 9:29, long after Flight 175 had already crashed. But this late starting time is contradicted by Richard Clark in Against All Enemies. It is also contradicted by Laura Brown of the FAA and Tom Flockel's source in the Transportation Department, both of whom said it started at about 8:20, more than an hour before the commission says. Although Laura Brown later, perhaps under pressure from superiors, changed the starting time to 8:45, this was still early enough for discussions of Flight 175 to have occurred in time for the plane to have been intercepted. There was also a teleconference initiated by the FAA. According to the 9/11 Commission, this teleconference was set up at about 9:20. But on May 22, 2003, Laura Brown sent a memo to the Commission headed FAA Communications with NORAD on September 11, 2001. The memo began, "Within minutes after the first aircraft hit the World Trade Center, the FAA immediately established several phone bridges. Since the attack on the North Tower was at 8:47, within minutes would mean that this teleconference began about 8:50. The memo made clear, moreover, that the teleconference included the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon and also NORAD. During this teleconference, Brown's memo said, the FAA shared real-time information about the loss of communication with aircraft, loss of transponder signals, unauthorized changes of course, and other actions being taken by all the flights of interest. And by 8:50, everyone agrees, Flight 175 was a flight of interest. Everyone except, of course, the 9/11 Commission, which claims that FAA headquarters had not yet learned about it. Laura Brown's memo, in any case, had been read into the Commission's own record on May 23, 2003. But when the Commission published its final report in 2004, it simply pretended that this memo did not exist. For several reasons, therefore, it appears that the Commission's claim that the military was not notified about Flight 175 until after it hit the South Tower is a lie from beginning to end. I turn now to the Commission's treatment of Flight 77 and the attack on the Pentagon. As we saw earlier, if the FAA told NORAD about Flight 77 at 9:24, NORAD should have had fighter jets in Washington before 9:38 when the Pentagon was struck. The 9/11 Commission's solution to this problem was to tell another new tale, according to which the FAA never told NORAD about this flight. One inconvenient fact, General Larry Arnold, the head of NORAD's U.S. Continental Region, had in open testimony to the Commission in 2003 repeated NORAD's statement that it had been notified about the hijacking at 9:24. Other NORAD officials, furthermore, had testified that fighters at Langley had been scrambled in response to this notification. The Commission handled this problem by simply saying that these statements by Arnold and the other NORAD officials were incorrect. The Commission, again, did not explain why NORAD officials had made incorrect statements. Were they confused or were they lying? But it said that those statements were unfortunate because they made it appear that the military had been notified in time to respond. The Commission's task was to convince us that this was not the case. Basic to the Commission's new story about Flight 77 is another tale of incredible incompetence by FAA officials. This tale goes like this. At 8:54, the FAA controller in Indianapolis, after seeing Flight 77 go off course, lost its transponder signal and even its radar track. Rather than reporting the flight as possibly hijacked, however, he assumed that it had crashed.